dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
3, 2, 1. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. This program has earned that moniker, I think, at least in substantial part because of the contribution made to our intelligence briefings each week by Gordon Chang. Gordon is, of course, a renowned author, among other things, of a terrific book, The Coming Collapse of China, an essayist of unbelievable productivity and acumen, including in places like the Gateway Institute and the National Interest, and Newsweek, where, in fact, he is the author of the print edition's cover story on, well, what I call the genocide games, the Winter Olympics in Beijing just getting underway as we speak. Gordon is, of course, a man to be followed closely at places like Twitter, where you can do as I do, follow him at Gordon G. Chang. It's great to have you back with us, sir. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Frank.
It is the day we have dreaded for some time, the opening of these genocide games. Gordon, talk a little bit about what we've seen so far, notably the appearance with Xi of Vladimir Putin of Russia, and what these games are likely to entail with the United States, not diplomatically, of course, but in other ways, both participating in, endorsing, and enabling them, along with most of the rest of the world.
The most important thing in the last few hours is that Vladimir Putin met with Xi Jinping on the day of the opening ceremony in Beijing. And of course, China called upon NATO to halt its expansion, which is really Vladimir Putin's narrative. China, for the last several weeks, has been blaming the United States and NATO for provoking the crisis in Ukraine, for precisely that, moving closer towards Russia's border. That narrative is false, of course, but Beijing is promoting it. Also, we have seen Ned Price, the State Department spokesman, on Thursday actually said, issued a warning to Chinese companies not to backfill American sanctions that could be imposed on Russia. We have threatened sanctions on Russia should it invade Ukraine. The concern is that Chinese companies would then rush in and support the Russian economy. And the United States is now warning China not to do that. This is now a controversy which is going to become perhaps a conflict, and we're starting to see the opening moves around the games.
Gordon, what about this point that Xi, a dictator in China, will, like the dictator of Nazi Germany in 1936, interpret the participation of this so-called international community in these Olympics as proof of the willingness of these other nations to avert their gaze, shall we say, from oppression at home and aggression abroad, and thereby embolden the dictator in question, at the moment Xi, to do more of both?
That is certainly Xi Jinping's hope. You know, people talk about the 1936 Berlin Olympics being the same as the Olympics now. Actually, the corresponding event was the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing, which was generally called China's coming out party. And that did legitimize and strengthen substantially the Communist Party. Xi Jinping hopes to do the same with the 2022 Winter Olympics. I think it might actually backfire on him for a number of reasons. But nonetheless, it has become the lightning rod. This is a pivotal event because whether it goes one way or the other, it will have a substantial effect, not only on China, not only on the world, but it is also going to be, I think, the place where we view, in retrospect, China's trajectory, either further up or down.
Well, tease that out for us, Gordon. You've written at Newsweek about Xi's internal problems and how if this isn't a wild success, they may be greatly compounded. I've taken the glass half full approach uncharacteristically and said, well, if they are a success, this will strengthen his position at home. And as I say, perhaps incite him or at least encourage him to more of what he has in mind vis-a-vis Taiwan or India or both.
That's certainly his goal. The context, of course, is that Xi Jinping is looking for a precedent-breaking third term as General Secretary of the Communist Party. The Communist Party probably will hold its 20th National Congress in October or November of this year when that decision will be made. And many people say that he's going to get it. That is the almost unanimous view of China watchers and the world. And also, I think people say, and this is probably right, that if he does get that third term, he becomes dictator for life. So Xi Jinping has a lot on the line. Remember, he took a consensual political system in 2012 when he became general secretary, where no Chinese leader got too much credit or too much blame because every decision was shared across the Politburo Standing Committee, which is the body at the top of the Communist Party. What Xi Jinping did, though, was he took power from everybody else, which means he grabbed accountability, which means that when things go well for China, as they did, let's say, 3 or 4 years ago, this was very good for Xi Jinping, and it bolstered his position. But when things have been going poorly for China, as they have for the last couple of years, that means that Xi Jinping is subject to unprecedented criticism. And that's why I believe his position is fragile. I'm not going to say he's not going to get his third term. We don't really know that yet, but this Olympics is important for him. Because if it goes well, as you point out, he will get that third term. If it doesn't go well, then he is subject to all sorts of punishments, including not getting his third term, losing his freedom, losing his assets, and maybe even worse.
The stakes are very high indeed. It would seem to me, Gordon, that the logic of what you've just said is that we in the United States should be doing everything we can to deny Xi a successful Olympics. Sadly, we have not simply refused to participate in them. I think that was a terrible mistake. But one idea is, and we've been promoting it at our website, genocidegames.org, is for people to make plain that they're not going to watch these Olympics. At the very least we can do is deny Xi, and for that matter, his enablers at NBC, the broadcaster that's covering these games, the global audience that they seek in the hopes of, again, demonstrating and exploiting this propaganda windfall.
Yes, I'm personally not watching the Olympics. I love to watch the games, but I'm not watching this year out of the principle that you talked about. And I think that we should not have sent athletes to the Winter Olympics for various reasons, including that they are the genocide games, that the athletes we can't guarantee their safety. Coronavirus is ripping through China. You name it. And it is wrong for us to allow our companies to broadcast the games or to sponsor them. And the President of the United States should have used his powers under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977 to prohibit any contact with the Olympics. They are that important. Now, I understand the plight of individual athletes, and certainly I understand that they would be denied this opportunity of a lifetime. But we got to remember that at the same time, Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and other Turkic minorities are being held in concentration camps. They're being killed, tortured, raped, enslaved. Their organs are being harvested involuntarily. Children are being imprisoned in essentially camps. These are the indescribable, unspeakable crimes. And that's what we have to measure our participation against, that by doing anything to support the games, we have become complicit in the worst crimes of humanity since the Second World War.
That was exceedingly elegantly put, Gordon. And I just wanted to say that in addition to the crimes you've mentioned, and of course, they're just a sample of what is afoot, there is a new report, I believe just out, from Nina Shea, our colleague at the Hudson Institute, about another genocide in which the Chinese Communist Party is destroying members of this Falun Gong community through an industrial-scale organ harvesting. Forcibly removing their organs for profit, no less. These are unspeakable crimes against humanity, as you say, Gordon, and my fear that all of them will be seemingly, if not actually approved, given a blind eye by this international community, furthering Xi's confidence that they can be pursued with utter impunity. It's terrifying when you think that that may be, you know, the upshot both at home, as I said, and abroad. Another thought on this, Gordon, that I'd like you to comment, if you will, and maybe on the Falun Gong business too, is Xi's choice as the torchbearer of a man who was at the pointy end of the spear with respect to China's recent incursion against India, perhaps a portent of things to come there too.
Yes. China has made Qi Baobo a regimental commander in the Galwan Valley, a torchbearer, and that is flaunting its aggression against India. India has pulled out of the opening ceremony because of it. This just shows you the arrogance, pure arrogance of the Chinese regime right now. And Frank, if I may, when we talk about genocides, we shouldn't forget Tibetans. And there's one other genocide, which has killed 5.7 million people as of today, including 877,000 Americans. And that is China deliberately spread the coronavirus beyond its borders. That is actually a genocide as defined in Article 2 of the Genocide Convention of 1948, because it targets a specific group, non-Chinese. Chinese leaders, whatever the origin of this disease, and I think it did come from a lab, but at this point we can't prove that. But the one thing we can prove is that Chinese leaders lied about contagiousness, and while they were locking down their own country, they were trying to persuade other countries to accept arrivals from China without travel restrictions or quarantines. And that meant that they wanted this disease to kill others outside of China. So that's 5.7 million people. 877,000 Americans as of this morning. That's a genocide as well.
Gordon, we're going to be talking shortly with Lawrence Sellin about ongoing Chinese biological warfare activities benefiting from American research institutions, scientists, technology transfers, and underwriting. And the fact that this is still going on in the backdrop of what you say is a genocide against us, among others, for heaven's sakes. It's just unbelievable. And this is a fascinating conversation with Lawrence coming up. Let me ask you about one other thing, if I can, Gordon, just back to Putin for a moment. It seems fairly clear that Putin's Russia is now, if not actually a vassal state of China, certainly a very junior partner in a strategic relationship. Is that evident to you from the dealings that we've been treated to, including this one today? And what are the implications of that, do you think, for Chinese conduct in the future, perhaps even against Russia itself?
Yeah. If you look at the relations between Moscow and Beijing for the last 5 years, it's clear that the Russians are the junior partners in this new axis. It's just because the Russians have an economy which is under $2 trillion. The Chinese have one which is something like $16 trillion. So that tells you most of what you need to know about the relations between Moscow and Beijing these days. What this says is, even though Russia is a weak state in a sense, it is playing a weak hand very well. You look at two strong states run by strongmen who actually, I think, are driving global events. The United States, which is a far stronger state if you look at the metrics, is very weak right now. And that portends real danger for the international community as we go forward. This is one of the most exceedingly dangerous times in history.
It is indeed. Gordon, lastly, speaking of dangerous times, and a somewhat absurd development, it's been announced that North Korea, of all places, will be the presiding nation, the president of the Conference on Disarmament in the month of June. Just quickly, Gordon, the last time I checked, the North Koreans were not remotely interested in disarmament. They were arming to the teeth. And the numbers of flights of missiles of various kinds in just the past couple of months speaks rather powerfully to that point, does it not?
There can be very little said about this, Frank, except to say this shows the fundamental weakness of the UN system, where you have human rights abusers chair the UN Council on Human Rights, and North Korea and other proliferators chairing the Conference on Disarmament. It shows where the world is these days, and it shows ultimately the failure of American leadership in multilateral institutions, not only at the UN, but at other ones. We have allowed bad actors to control and take over these organizations to the detriment of the world.
A last point on this topic, Gordon, would certainly seem to me as well to undermine completely the idea that one can safely negotiate some sort of end-of-war agreement with the North Korean regime. Does it not?
The end-of-war declaration is certainly disadvantageous to everybody except those who want war. You can't, as Nick Eberstadt of the American Enterprise Institute say, declare peace without peace. And that's what South Korea is trying to do. Moon Jae-in, who will be president only for a few more months, is trying to create a legacy, and that is an end to the Korean War. He can't do that with a formal peace treaty, and so he's trying to do it with the declaration. Unfortunately, what this will do is people in the United States and South Korea will use this declaration, if it were ever made, to break the alliance between the United States and South Korea, get U.S. troops off the Korean Peninsula, and thereby allow North Korea to take over South Korea. And that's what many people in South Korea want, who are pushing this declaration. Most people in South Korea, of course, don't want this. But unfortunately, at this moment, the leftists and the progressive now control the political system in Seoul.
Well, I would have one fillip to the comment by Nick Eberstadt, who is a brilliant demographer and strategic thinker. The only circumstance in which you can have peace without peace is if you're prepared to surrender. And I fear that's exactly what Moon Jae-in has in mind. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for your time today, my friend, as well as for your contributions to this program each week. They are incalculably important, as I know our audience agrees. I hope that you will continue to be a driving force. Congratulations not only on the Newsweek cover, but also on your appearance this past weekend with Mark Levin. They were terrific. And I know you'll keep up that great work here as well. Godspeed, my friend. We'll talk with you soon. Lauren Sellin is up next. As described, chilling stuff. Stay tuned.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. And I'm always delighted to be able to say we are back with Dr. Colonel Lawrence Sellin, United States Army Reserves, a man who has served his country not only with distinction and in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan with the United States Army, but also in a variety of civilian capacities, including as a business executive and a researcher who has done some important work on virology at, among other places, the Army's biodefense facility at Fort Detrick, Maryland. Colonel Sellin is contributing immeasurably important articles on aspects of the COVID-19 phenomenon. I think of it as really a biological warfare attack by the Chinese Communist Party. On the pages of the Gateway Pundit, an extraordinarily important online resource. And we're always delighted to have a chance to catch up with him, even if, as is often the case, the tidings are grim. Dr. Sellin, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you, Frank.
Some of the pieces you've been doing recently, Lawrence, are simply breathtaking in their implications. Give us kind of the short form of what you have found in your research and its implications for us.
Well, let me give you the bottom line up front, Frank. U.S. research programs are massively infiltrated by Chinese Communist Party and People's Liberation Army scientists who immigrated to the United States over the last 30 years and are now in positions of responsibility in every major American university and in U.S. government laboratories, including those of the National Institutes of Health and the Department of Defense. Now, the research laboratories have become little more than Chinese colonies, extensions of China's fused military-civilian research programs, and in fact, fully funded by the U.S. taxpayer. Chinese scientists working in the United States, many of whom have become U.S. citizens, have remained loyal to the Chinese Communist Party and are actively collaborating with their counterparts in China, including with the People's Liberation Army. Now, many of those collaborations are hidden within U.S. government research funding awarded to U.S. scientists or Chinese scientists working in the United States, which appear on the surface to be U.S. focused research, but in actuality are subsidizing China's research programs.
Lawrence, there's so much in there that's important to unpack, but let me just ask you to pick up on one point, because you've discussed it in some of your writings at Great Gateway Pundit, but I don't think most of us, probably not our audience so much, but most Americans actually understand what is meant by this term military civil fusion in China.
Yes, indeed. In 2016, the Chinese Communist Party, in their 13th five-year plan, actually mandated the fusion of civilian and military research. So what you have are the military research centers, much of which is devoted to biological warfare. And this is comprised of military research institutes and military hospitals. Now, layered on top of that, and this is part of the fusion program, are all of China's universities and all of, quote, civilian research centers like the Wuhan Institute of Virology and even some of the Chinese biotech companies. Now, those two layers that are within China, which is the fused civilian military research program, allows the military to access through Chinese universities, universities in the United States and elsewhere in the world, to obtain knowledge, skills, technology, and even support funding from outside of China to support China's own research and development programs.
And when you say China's research and development programs, you know, you've indicated that substantially those are involved in a biological warfare program. And Lawrence, as you know and documented, its target is us. So when you talk about these universities in the United States, when you talk about these scientists, some of whom are trained People's Liberation Army specialists, are deeply embedded in, and in some cases running, for heaven's sakes, programs inside the United States, you've found evidence that that is really in the service of these research operations and BW activities in China. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Frank. And let me give you two examples. Recently, Tucker Carlson on the Fox News Channel discussed Dr. Peter Hotez of Baylor College of Medicine, who Tucker accused of being a medical charlatan disseminating politically motivated medical disinformation and supporting the imprisonment of those with opinions opposed to his. Well, it's actually worse than that. Last December, I reported on Dr. Hotez's connection with China's military. Now, he has a research grant entitled Receptor Binding Domain Recombinant Protein-Based SARS Vaccine for Biodefense, and this amounts to $1 million per year, which was awarded by Dr. Anthony Fauci's institute to Professor Peter Hotez of Baylor College of Medicine as the project leader. Now, note this grant deals with U.S. biodefense. Now, in fact, one of the other principal investigators embedded in the project is Shibu Zhang. Now, I have exhaustively documented Shibu Zhang's connection with China's People's Liberation Army. Briefly, Shibu Zhang was actually trained as a military doctor in the People's Liberation Army's first and fourth medical universities. Now, during the 20 years Shibu Zhang was working in the United States, he developed an extensive network of collaborative research with other U.S. virus research laboratories and received more than $17 million in grants, most of it coming from Anthony Fauci's Institute. Now, during this entire period, Shibu Zhang was actively collaborating with the People's Liberation Army laboratories while simultaneously inviting into his U.S. laboratories and training scientists linked to China's military. So this is a case where you have a Chinese military scientist embedded within a research grant that was given to a U.S. researcher, in this case, Dr. Peter Hotez of Baylor College of Medicine in Texas.
Yeah, that's troubling. But so is the other stuff that you've just reported on. And Lawrence, I mean, look, this would be slanderous if it's not true. I assume that you have carefully documented what you've said here, and the implications of it are staggering. Our friend Steve Bannon is given to saying nobody sued you over these kinds of charges to date, I gather. So presumably that's because they know they're correct and damning in the extreme.
Well, it's public information. It's open source. What I usually do is simply follow the publications of these individuals and who is funding these publications, and you can check back with the NIH's database to see where the money is coming from and where it's flowing. And in this case, you see a lot of money, for example, from Anthony Fauci's Institute being funneled, for example, through Dr. Peter Hotez of Baylor College of Medicine, and to support the research of multiple Chinese scientists with connections with the People's Liberation Army. Now, the second example I gave in the past week was even more remarkable. There was a Chinese scientist named Xiao Yuan Chen, and he came to the United States 25 years ago to study. He received his PhD in chemistry from the University of Idaho in 1999, did postdoctoral training at Syracuse and Washington University in St. Louis before becoming an assistant professor at Stanford University in 2004. So that is Xiao Yuan Chen received his entire scientific training in the United States. And then in 2019, he became a permanent employee of the National Institutes of Health, eventually becoming chief of the Laboratory of Molecular Imaging and Nanomedicine. Now, during this entire period, Xiao Yuan Chen, when he was in the United States, while he's being paid a high salary by the U.S. government and received in excess of $38 million in NIH research funding, he maintained a secretive parallel career working with the Chinese People's Liberation Army and, in fact, establishing a mirror image of his NIH research activities in Xiamen University in China. Now, there are numerous scientific publications co-authored by Xiao Yuan Chen and the People's Liberation Army scientists, and these publications do not appear in the NIH publication record for him, even though the article states that the research was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Now, as I mentioned, while he was working at the NIH in 2012, he established a parallel research center in Xiamen University called the Center of Molecular Imaging and Translational Medicine, of which he is head. At the same time, he uses NIH laboratory to train Chinese students for the Xiamen University Center, as well as training scientists from the People's Liberation Army. So there you have it.
This is almost too much to absorb. You've described a pattern of behavior, Lawrence Sellin, in which American institutions, including our government, have actively collaborated with, trained, recruited, and in some cases put on the payroll individuals who have been, in some cases, trained by the People's Liberation Army, or are, in every case, it seems, working for them, or at least working for the Chinese Communist Party, which is the same thing. And this pattern of behavior, I think I say this to you each time you come on the program, Lawrence, the pattern of behavior, as best you can determine it, is continuing. Even now, in the face of what we've learned, well, most immediately from your own reporting, of course, Gateway Pundit, but more broadly, what we've learned about the Chinese Communist Party's biological warfare program and their use of it against our country, and what they have in mind doing even more of in that regard. This is simply scandalous. It's treason. I don't know what other word to use for it. Is it not?
Well, I think you use the exact term, Frank. It's correct to call it a pattern of behavior, because this behavior is not just these two examples. It's occurring in every major university in the United States, that money is being funneled from taxpayers through these institutions to support China's research and development program. In particular, its biological warfare program, because many of the people who are being, many of the Chinese scientists who are being trained in the United States through these programs are working in China's biological warfare program. And the connections are quite clear. As I said, all you need to do is follow the publications and see where the money is flowing through.
Lawrence Selland, you've served in the United States Armed Forces. You've been cleared to have access to sensitive information. You have a firsthand familiarity, of course, with the business of intelligence, because it, to some extent, you know, enables you to survive or perish on the battlefield if you don't. This battlefield is different, perhaps bigger, but ominously, vastly more important than just about any battlefield I can think of. And yet, we seem to have a complete collapse of counterintelligence with respect to safeguarding these sorts of technologies and, know-how and training from our mortal enemies. And again, I don't know how else to describe this pattern of behavior other than treasonous, but whatever you want to call it, it is highly dangerous to our country, is it not? Is it? Am I missing something here? Is there some good news that I'm overlooking somehow that makes this all okay?
Unfortunately, Frank, there is no good news. There is no counterintelligence on these issues. There is no accountability for how the money is being spent. And the Chinese are quite brazen about it. You know, what they're doing in the United States in terms of civilian military research, these Chinese scientists who are in the United States, is really a mirror image of what China is doing in China in regard to the fusion of civilian and military research. So they're, quote, they would describe what they're doing as doing civilian research in the United States, but they're actually collaborating with the military in China. So it's the research is going on in the United States by these Chinese scientists who are in the United States is simply part of China's fused military civilian research program, and nobody is doing anything to stop it.
What you've inspired me to say is they're fusing our research programs with theirs. It is now part of, as you say, a colonization of our institutions, of higher learning, government entities like the National Institute of Health, where some of the cutting edge work is done in spaces that are civilian in character, to be sure, but clearly have a dual use application. And they are subverting in the process, I have to believe, you know, our scientists and the institutions that they've penetrated. This is a scandal of the first order. And Lawrence Selland, I cannot thank you enough for what you have been doing doggedly, week upon week, tenaciously, rigorously, to document what's going on here. And it is certainly our purpose at the Center for Security Policy and this program and our television program, which you will also be joining us on this weekend, Securing America on Real America's Voice channel to call attention to your findings and demand action by our government to protect us against the peril that is clearly entailed. Lawrence Sellin, thank you for your time today, for the extraordinary work you're doing, and my heartfelt thanks to Jim and Joe Hoft, the Hoft brothers as they're known, of Gateway Pundit, for the platform that they've afforded you to get this information out. And I hope that it will become, you know, the focus of concerted action by those responsible for, if not actually the conduct of intelligence and counterintelligence in this country, certainly those on Capitol Hill who are responsible for overseeing it. In the meantime, my friend, I know you'll keep up the good work, and I look forward to our next visit as soon as possible. And in the meantime, thank you for today's chat, and Godspeed in your work. Next up, we'll speak with former Assistant Secretary of State Robert Charles about Ukraine, the Olympics, and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're always pleased to be able to say welcome to our next guest. His name is Robert Charles. He served, among other things, as an Assistant Secretary of State during the George W. Bush administration. He also, in previous capacities, was congressional counsel at the White House for Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Before that, he was an intelligence officer in the United States Navy. He is a man of considerable accomplishment, a very, very prolific contributor to the public policy debate, notably through Fox News and other outlets, but most especially in his role as a spokesman for a superb organization, the Association of Mature American Citizens, AMAC. And you can follow him there at amac.us. Robert Charles, it's good to have you back, sir. Welcome. There's a special urgency to our conversation, I think, because earlier in the day, Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping of China announced a new strategic partnership, which they described in terms that I think can only be considered, well, alarming by Americans. Talk us through what you think might flow from this alliance, which has been developing for some time, and I think worryingly so, but apparently is going into a very new and aggressive phase.
Yeah, I think what I will say, Frank, about this right now, and it is a very significant statement publicly by these two countries in their official capacities, is that it is both strategically significant and it will become swiftly tactically significant. I think it reminds me in a strange sort of unsettling way of the what was at the time the secret German pre-World War II German-Soviet non-aggression pact. Which incidentally broke down, of course, but nevertheless, you know, this is sort of like a Chinese Russian aggression pact. They've made it very public for obvious reasons. What it tells me is several things. First, there ought to be an immediate unifying effect, I would like to hope, on all Western countries that believe in anything close to democracy or republican government. And self-determination is clearly under direct assault by the language in that agreement. They see communism and autocracy as the way of the future. We need to stand up boldly and with a unified voice, indeed I would call it a global chorus, and say with profound seriousness that the future of democracy is not going to be being taken out by communism or autocracy. There will be autocrats, I have no doubt. I won't name them, but that will probably join this new axis declaration. Axis of evil goes back to the Bush era declaration, but it also goes back beyond that to the axis of World War II. And I believe this is essentially an axis of, let's call it again, an axis of evil. The idea that you will intentionally undermine, which is what this agreement says, you will intentionally undermine all Western definitions of human rights. You will essentially codify and collaborate for the purposes of aggression and presumably world dominance, which is something that China talked about last year. I think it's very frightening because it declares, even though I think democracy will eventually prevail if we all stand up together and with strength and shoulder to shoulder, it declares an intent to take down all the democratic norms that were established really at our revolution and post-World War II globally. So it's a very dangerous turn of events. And I obviously, pacts break down, but at the same time, you've got essentially each of them having each other's backs, China and Russia playing, which we predicted. I mean, many of us predicted this year, a couple of years ago, and certainly within the last 1 year, that they would essentially have each other's backs when one attempts to go into Ukraine and the other goes into Taiwan. I mean, this is the subtext to this document, beyond which there is the strategic effect, which is that it's supposed to sort of nullify, in effect, frighten Western countries into sitting down and shutting up. And I sure hope we don't do that.
I do too, Robert, and I think there's a considerable risk that that's exactly what we'll do in this circumstance under Joe Biden, for sure. I'd like to just do a thought experiment with you. We talked a little bit about this earlier in the program with Gordon Chang, but I'd be interested in your take on it. Russia is clearly the junior partner in this relationship. One might even say it's accepting a vassal state relationship with the superior power of China, meaning that it's likely to do what it's told by the Chinese, that its sovereignty may be subordinated to dictates by China. And certainly Eastern Russia, which the Chinese have made very little secret of having, having coveted for some time, may well, in due course, become essentially colonized by the Chinese. And I just wonder, as you say, pacts break down. Not only might this one be rather short-lived in light of all of that, and should we be making it our strategic purpose to try to foster divisions between them?
You know, I think we should, but I think that we should confront them independently, and particularly China, with a much higher level of seriousness than most people are sort of looking at this with. In other words, there's a near-term value in that this will allow them to paper over for each other aggression against sovereign third countries. But there is also a strategic, I think a very significant strategic security component to this as I think about it. Russia has tens of thousands of ICBMs. China does not. They are making ICBM fields now as fast as they can make them. I could see a real danger to us if you had a proliferation, even within the geography of those two countries, of ICBMs all pointed at us. I think that the idea of space is really code. They've talked about cooperation in space. It's really code for integrating the Russians into the new Chinese space station that went up last year, and simultaneously beginning the process of saying that the Western norms, the UN norms, the space treaty norms that say you don't militarize space are all outdated, and they will therefore begin deploying weapons in space. That becomes extremely dangerous because, they've already both experimented with hypersonic weapons, which are an independent threat to the United States, but they've gone a step further, and they're now talking about space. And I think what they're really talking about is putting us at maximum vulnerability. All of our commsats, what we're talking on right now, what people are listening to this on right now, depend on communication satellites in geosynchronous orbit. If the Russians agree with the Chinese and essentially strong arm the world into saying that we can put weapons up there that knock them out at any time, then even basic communications, even social media, are all put at risk, never mind the security of a country. And then the reference to the internet, you know, to me, that says cyber warfare cooperation.
Well, among other things, I think one of the terrible mistakes that the Obama administration made was relinquishing control of just the mechanics of the internet, which they did as a giveaway, it seems to me, to these states and others.
I mean, I think this also points to the fact, and Newt Gingrich has been vocal on this, as have a number of other people, but it points to the fact that, Chinese dominance through 5G and ultimately 6G, 7G out there of all of the third and second world in cooperation with Russia is part of what they're looking at. I mean, this will be a constant, I don't think we've heard the last of this agreement. And I think that the reality is that we're all going to have to contend with the fact that these two are now boldly saying that they will go where no decent human being has ever gone before, i.e., well, they will cooperate in order to imperil the West.
Let me ask you about one other thing, Bobby, before we run out of time with you. I wanted to turn to another piece of the Russian story, and that is what it's up to with respect to Ukraine. You mentioned that the Chinese would have the Russians back if they do decide to invade, and the Russians, conversely, perhaps the Chinese back if they go at it with at least Taiwan, if not India, which is a bit of a client of Russia, or certainly has been. But let me ask you about the piece that you wrote for AMAC. Was very thoughtful, very detailed, really, on the complex history and the consequent complexities of the challenge that we're now facing in that regard. Talk about what's going on with Russia and Ukraine as you see it at the moment.
Yeah, you know, Frank, that's like, can you please give me the history of the world in the next 30 before we, you know, tie it down? Truth be told, the history, and I appreciate it. Truth be told, I mean, this is a very complex part of the world. And the Russian influence in the Crimea and beyond in Ukraine goes back to, I mean, if not the 1100s, I mean, it goes way back. And the relationship between the peoples of those two countries also goes way back. We like to think of things as all having happened in our lifetimes, and they did not. And so one of the things that piece does, and people can go to amac.us and read it from top to bottom, is it tries in a very fair and open way to explain what the equities are and why we're at this point. I'll just be brief. First, we're at this point chiefly because Russia has always both wanted a warm water port and had it for the better part of their lifetimes. And Ukraine, as a sovereign country, and had pledges from Russia, brokered actually by Jim Baker back in Bush 41, that there would not be a if Ukraine gave up their nuclear weapons, there would not be an affront by Russia. At the same time, there was sort of a kind of a wink and a nod about what would happen to Ukraine relative to NATO. And now Russia has always been somewhat paranoid about countries on their contiguous border. And one can argue that because they were invaded by both France and Russia or Soviet Union, there's an understanding about why. And they have a very expansive, sprawling geography. On the other hand, you don't just go in and invade another country because you're concerned that they might have an alliance that would put you at some risk. And I will note that this is a part of a much bigger chess game where not only does this in some ways perhaps allow China to consider doing something similar relative to Taiwan or other countries, but it also is kind of masking something else that's going on in the left hand as the right hand goes and gets all the attention at the border of Ukraine. And that is that there are troops, there are Russian forces, there are Russian, I don't want to call them little green men, but let's just say there are Russian affiliated bodies of people against the borders of Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland, as well as the north of Ukraine. And that is happening in real time right now, even as they put a lot more materiel on the border of Ukraine. And so, by the way, note, those are three NATO countries. So even as you hear writers saying, gosh, is NATO gone wobbly? Russia is saying, gosh, sure want to make NATO go wobbly and want to get Europe to be fully dependent on us out of a combination of carrots and sticks. We want to scare them and we want to induce them. We'll induce them with oil, we'll scare them with the military, and they'll become our sphere of influence, not the United States, not affiliated with the United States. China would love nothing better than that. It fits back with our earlier conversation. And I'll just end by saying, although it's complex, there's no question that Russia should not, obviously should not invade a sovereign foreign country that may or may not have a future in NATO. It may not, but it may. And we should, you know, one of my bigger concerns is that Biden wrote a secret letter to Putin, and I'd really like to know what's in that letter. I sure as heck hope it does not say, don't worry, Ukraine will never be part of NATO. That would be appeasement in the worst way, and that would encourage Russia, frankly, to walk straight in with 175,000 troops, which is probably what they have on that border now.
Bobby, it seems to me that you've put your finger on it. The Russians have the option to go in. They may feel every incentive to do it, at least with respect to, first, the Chinese having their back, as you put it, and secondly, the weakness of the U.S. administration. They may, however, also get what they want without going in. And that speaks to your question about what's in that secret letter. It's very, very unsettling that Biden has been, on the one hand, negotiating, given his severe limitations, shall we put it mildly, as well as that he's doing so, it seems, behind the back of the Ukrainians, and perhaps, for that matter, the rest of NATO. It's a very troubling thing.
It is, and I find it fascinating, Frank, that we took time, the media and the Democratic Party, if I may say, became obsessed with the idea that what was Trump going to say to Putin in quiet before anybody else knew what he was saying, or this whole Russia collusion really nonsense. And yet, what you really have here is bona fides. If that letter appeases the Russians by essentially saying we will not provide offensive weapons to Ukraine, we will not come to their defense, and we will not give them room in NATO, then that is the kind of collusion that really damages the future of Europe and the future of the United States and the future of our strategic alliances. It is exactly what we should be worried about. And don't think if they get away with this letter and Putin feels that he got what he wanted, then let's just look around the corner and we're probably going to see a letter from a secret letter from Biden to Xi saying, look, if you want to just intimidate Taiwan into agreeing to be part of mainland China by threat of force, we won't do anything. I sure hope that's not happening.
Well, again, the concern is that if Putin is emboldened by Biden's weakness, especially in the aftermath of Afghanistan, the Chinese have to be even more, especially given the degree to which they have compromised him. And that is something that continues to be missing from this discussion. What does that mean? Bobby, I know you feel as strongly as I do about this, that this is the ultimate peril for our country, that the most dangerous enemy we've ever faced has a hold, has its claws, one might say, into Joe Biden and his family. And I think it's part of their standard operating procedure to exploit such relationships. And why they wouldn't do it in this case is a complete mystery to me. And why this isn't the most important national security scandal and being treated as such in our time is just, again, beyond me.
Yeah, I think, Frank, you in turn sort of refine this argument a little tighter. And I think it's important to know what you're really saying. And that is that public corruption has consequences that can become strategic and imperil an entire country and its security. And that's really what happened here. You have public corruption going back. I mean, we all know the stories. It's not worth recounting them. And the money flows between that family and Communist Party-affiliated organizations. And I think the question, whether you draw a straight line or you use circumstantial evidence or you try to prove a case or you don't try to prove a case, what we know is that at the periphery, all of us who sit out here on the periphery, we know that this sure stinks of public corruption. And public corruption itself can imperil the security of an entire country. And that is potentially what's happening. The other thing I just want to point out is that what we're witnessing here is a, I guess I'll use the word dereliction. It's a dereliction of the most fundamental aspect of the oath of office, which is protect and defend the Constitution, which means also the integrity of the country. And I am concerned. I mean, for lack of a better way to say it, where are the generals that should be standing up? Where are the cabinet members that should be standing up? Where are the Democrats in Congress that should be standing up? Where are the people who should be saying, look, I love the Democratic Party, but by God, if it's going to take down my country comes first. And so that's where I stand. Where are those people?
Thank you so much, Robert Charles, for both your past service to our country and that you're rendering these days, among other places, at amac.us, for joining us very frequently. We really appreciate your time. And that of all the rest of you, we'll look forward to reconvening with you next week, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.